time, so that way we have time for everything. Okay, so good evening, everyone. And okay, looks like a few more people logged in. Mitchell and Marina, welcome. And Gloria. Gloria, also long time no see as well. Okay, great. And we have a phone on, 789. That's Erwin Niedober. So I hope I've acknowledged everyone's presence who is with us. Welcome, Jenny. And let's begin. So last week, we are on Gimel Amid Beis, actually. Technically, we made it to the top of Dalet Amid Aleph. We made it to the top of 4a. But the thing is, our sugya, our topic about mikvaos, really ranges from the bottom of Gimel Amid Beis to about the middle or so of Dalet Amid Aleph. So what we're going to do actually is we're going to rewind a little bit. You know, imagine it's a TV show and we say previously on our weekly Talmud Shiur. So we're going to do a little recap of what we ended off with. And that way we have the foundation to move forward and understand the rest of the sugya. How does that sound?
Good.
All right. I'm glad we're in agreement. So for those who are following, who I guess you have the art scroll, it's probably imagining it's the last page for 3B and it's 3B to the fourth power. 3B to the fourth power. Got it. And if you're in the text of the Gemara, it's four lines up from the bottom. I happen to have a little period in my Gemara. It's the middle of the line. The Amar Rav Yehuda, Amar Rav. And again, if you're on Safaria, I can't really tell you where, but if you search the words, a lug, you'll probably find it more or less. Okay, so let's begin. So a little bit of background. So something good to know about how mikvos work. So does anyone recall what's the shear? How much water do I have to have in a mikvah in order for it to be kosher? What did we learn?
40.
40. 40 sa'ah. Very good. 40 sa'ah. And again, I remember I read Rabbi Jachter article a while ago. He gives you more or less the precise fluid ounces. I'm not remembering offhand, but it's a substantial amount of water. I mean, go to our mikvah. You'll see it's a substantial amount of water that you need for a kosher mikvah. I'm sure we do a little more than necessary. That way we play it safe. So here's the thing. Except for an aberrant opinion of the rabbi we'll leave aside, the consensus is once a mikvah hits the requisite shear, the requisite amount of 40 sa'ah, I can pour disqualified water in there and it will not affect the kashrus of the mikvah. It will become part of the mikvah and will not render the mikvah non-kosher. Now, what could render a mikvah not kosher? Well, if you have something called mayim shu'uvim, drawn water, mikvah water is either a spring or from rainwater. So either natural water from the ground or it's rainwater. But if I have mayim shu'uvim, if I take my Poland Spring water bottle, that it was drawn water, it's in a clean-out vessel, and I pour it in, that water is disqualified for mikvos. So what's the issue? If I have a 40-sum mikvah, it's not problematic. Well, here's the thing. If I don't yet have a kosher mikvah, if I'm only starting to make the mikvah, then if I'm in the middle of filling it up, let's say I only have 20 sah of water. I'm halfway there. If I put in 3 lugin of water, then 3 lugin will disqualify that entire mikvah. That small amount. Just again, to give you an idea what 3 lug is, I don't have the exact measurement offhand, but again, a revius of water is between 3 to 4 fluid ounces, more or less. And so that's a revius a lug. That's a fourth of a lug. So multiply that by 4, then multiply that by 3, and that's what it is. So again, anyone who wants to do the math, you'll let us know how much that is in fluid ounces. So what our Gemara is going to deal with here is that premise. That's important to know. 3 lugin, while you're middle of making a mikvah, you're not at the requisite amount yet, will disqualify the kashrus of that mikvah. Okay? Mm-hmm. Anything on that I could clarify before we jump in? Because the whole Gemara is predicated on that introduction. Okay, great. So let's jump right in. Ba'amar Rav Yehuda Amar Rav. Shloshes lugin mayim shenapel esokan kurtav shel yayin. If I have 3 lugin, again, right? The 3 lugin of water that could disqualify a mikvah. And then I just put in a kurtav. A kurtav is a very minuscule amount of wine into those 3 lugin of water. Amar ayin kemare yayin. And now this water has the appearance of wine. The water turns red. V'nafla mikvah lo pasul. If that goes into a mikvah, it will not disqualify the mikvah. Wait a minute. You know, sure, there's wine in there, but there's also three lugin of water. Shouldn't the three lugin, ignoring the wine, disqualify the mikvah? Why do we care? What does this drop of wine do that changes everything? So maskibla Rav Kahana, b'chima bein zeb le'meit seva. The Tnan, Rabbi Yossi Omer, meit seva posin as a mikvah b'shloshes lugin. How is this any different? We have a Mishnah that tells us explicitly that colored water can still disqualify a mikvah. So what makes water with wine different than water with coloration? Water with wine won't disqualify a mikvah. Water that's colored maybe through dye or something else, that will disqualify a mikvah. What's the difference between the two of them? Amar le Rava, Hasa me ditseva mikri, hacha kama meziga mikri. Right, this was our Boy Scouts example from last time. Right, remember the joke again, not taking any sides politically, but just a good way to remember it. There's the classic thing during a Q&A, someone asked Ben Shapiro, how do you know Boy Scouts are only for boys and not for girls? He said, it's in the name, Boy Scouts. So forget your opinions on it, but this helps for the next part of the Gemara. Hasa mai ditseva mikri, how do I know that colored water is still water and that diluted wine is still wine? Because hasa mai ditseva mikri, the dyed water is referred to as colored water. It's water that happens to be colored. Hacha chamra meziga mikri. But over here, this wine that gets put into the water, it's not called colored water. It's called actually diluted wine. Therefore, since it is viewed as wine, you're not said to be putting water into the mikvah. You're putting diluted wine into the mikvah. And while diluted wine won't add, it won't contribute to the shear of 40 sa, to reaching the requisite amount of 40 sa, it won't detract from the mikvah either. It would not disqualify the mikvah. So that is the first part of the Gemara there. We ran through it at the end of the last time, but I just want to make sure it's clear. Any questions on that?
I found a footnote that gives the measurements.
Ah, okay.
The term kartav is used here to denote a minuscule amount. Technically, a kartav is 1/64th of a log, which is 1/4 fluid ounce, mm-hmm. or one, if I can read the number this light.
Well, a quarter fluid ounce.
192nd is the of three lugin.
What was that, Henry?
192 of.
This is the kartav, the defining the kartav, which is
yeah. So again, it's clearly not a negligible amount, but it's a minuscule amount, mm-hmm. but it could have a significant impact. Okay, so good. So those are the measurements. Anyone who has the art scrolls, you probably have them in your footnotes there. So excellent. Tani, but here's another question. Here's another challenge to our principle. So what do we say? Three lugin of water, but you would disqualify a mikvah, but you add a little bit of wine, it no longer has the potency to disqualify the mikvah. Here's the thing, though. Avatani Rabbi Chiya horidu as a mikvah. Avatani Rabbi Chiya horidu as a mikvah. Rabbi Chiya ruled that such mikvos are disqualified. So why would he say that? What's the basis of the disagreement? Rav thinks that such a mikvah is still kosher. Rabbi Chiya thinks that it's pasul. What's the base of their disagreement? So these are both Amorayim. The Gemara is going to tell us, actually, their dispute might be contingent on a machlokis, a dispute among Tanayim that can be found earlier in a Mishnah. Amarava, lo kasha, ha Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri, ha Rabbanan. This is a machlokis, a dispute between Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri and the Rabbanan. Ditznan, shloshes lugin mayim chaser kurtav. Shenafa l'sochan kurtav yayin, omar ayin kamara yayin, v'nafala mikvah, lo pasluhu. If I have, now notice the word over here, this is important. If I have, let's say, 2.9 whatever quart, lugin of water, not three lugin, a little short of three lugin, and then it reaches the shear of three lugin by me adding in a little bit of wine, that would not invalidate the mikvah. The chain gimel lugin mayim chaser kortav shenafel asochan kortav chalav umarein kamara mayim shenafel mikvah lo pasu. Same thing. You have almost three lugin of milk. Of water. You add in a few drops, a little bit of milk, and that reaches three lugin. Also, that would not disqualify the mikvah. Now, that's the opinion of the Rabbanan. What's the inference I can make here? The inference is that had there been three lugin of water independent of the wine, independent of the milk, if you add in milk, you add in wine, it's going to still disqualify the mikvah. That's what's going to happen. Now, why is that the case? Because according to the Rabbanan, it's not about what this looks like. We don't care if it looks like wine. We don't care if it looks like water so much. The point is that there is a shear. There is a quantity of three lugin. Anything else on top of that is not going to change things. If there is three lugin of H2O in there, it will invalidate the mikvah. That's the opinion of the Rabbanan. And now I know I made my own little chart here in the Gemara, which I'm going to refer to, but I took a quick look just out of curiosity. Apparently Art Scroll creates a chart there as well. I think they do, right? At least my edition that we have at home. If you look, maybe you have to flip one or two pages, but on the bottom in the footnotes, I recall Art Scroll had a had their own table, which might help if people look at that. But I'll do my best to explain. What was that, Toby?
Oh, I'm saying what? It's on 4A to the second power.
4A to the second power. Okay, great. So that's the opinion of the Rabbanan. Now I'll try to, for those who don't have the visual aid of Art Scroll, I'll try it. You know, apparently people have been learning this for ages before Art Scroll was created, so it is possible to understand it without it, so I'll do my best to explain it. Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri Omer, HaKoholich Acher Hamare. It's not based on, you know, you could have three lugin even. It could be even three lugin of water. But if it looks like wine, it's not water anymore. And it won't disqualify the mikvah. So now here's what's important. Here's an important distinction. Rabbi Yochanan disagrees when it comes to wine. He doesn't disagree when it comes to milk. Because wine will change the appearance of the water. Milk does not change the appearance of the water. So actually, you know what's very interesting according to Rabbi Yochanan? If I have 2.9 whatever lugin of water on its own, it would not be able to disqualify the mikvah. But the milk, in the words of Rashi, havu mashum luhu chalav, it will join together with the water, and the chalav, the milk, will complete the quantity required, the three lugin of water. Because the milk will not change the appearance. In fact, not only will it not change the appearance significantly, but it will contribute to the water hitting three lugin. That's what Rabbi Yochanan says. Mm. So Rabbi Yochanan is very lenient when it comes to wine, that if it's three lugin and there's wine, it will not invalidate the mikvah. But he's very mock, he's very strict when it comes to milk, that if you have less than three lugin, not only will milk, be neutral, it's not even neutral, it will help the water disqualify the mikvah.
I would think it would make the water cloudy.
So apparently there's a very little bit of milk again, right? So we'll have to, if this was like a practicum class we're doing, someone could bring in, like, get some milk and water, and if anyone has, I see some people at kitchens in the background, if anyone wants to do an experiment for us right now, that's okay. But you hopefully everyone, you can experiment after the shear. We'll get you the exact fluid ounces. You'll take a quart of a milk. You'll take the 2.9 so lugin of water. You'll mix it together and see what happens. You'll report back to me. But apparently the Gemara believes that there's not going to be a significant difference. Okay. So now what does this mean for us? Well, now we understand the basis of Rav. Remember before Rav said, if you have three lugin of water plus wine, it will not invalidate the mikvah. Who does Rav fit according to? Rav is in accordance with Rav Yochanan ben Nuri. Because Rav Yochanan ben Nuri says, HaKol Holich Acher Hamare. It's all based on what I see. If I'm looking at water, it's water. If it looks like wine, it's wine then. It's diluted wine. So that is in accordance with Rav, and Rav Yochanan ben Nuri agree with each other. But Rav would be at odds with the Rabbanan in the Mishnah, because the Rabbanan and Mishnah say, once you have three lugin of water, even if you add wine, game over. The mikvah is disqualified. So that is what we got up until this point. Okay. Let me just, if there's any strictly clarification questions that I can take. Is there anything unclear that I could clarify at this point? Okay, I'm glad we understand this because we're going to now complicate things even a little bit more. I remember one year I said that like one thing was like the most complicated sugya in Makos. Like, there's a few complicated sugyas right at the beginning that try to like, you know, maybe you're not allowed to say this nowadays, but to separate the men from the boys, so to speak, and the girls from the women, however you want to put it. So there's like a few of these at the beginning. So here we go. What we're going to report now is that there's actually a second reading, a second way to understand the disagreement between the Rabbanan and Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri. Now, what's a different way to change this? So you remember in the Brisa before, if you look literally the first word on Dalet Amud Aleph, it says Chaser Kortav. So what if according to some versions, it didn't have the word Chaser, missing a Kortav, but actually it was three complete Lugin and doesn't need that additional Kortav. That's what we're going to do right now. So Hamibai Bai La Rav Papa, we're about six lines down on Dalet Amud Aleph. Hamibai Bai La Rava Rav Papa Dibai Rav Papa. So Rav Papa had an inquiry. He's a little bit uncertain about the text of this Mishnah. Rav Tani Chaser Kortav Bereisha. So Rav's text may have been that it said Chaser Kortav, that there is not three lugin of water when the Rabbanan were saying that it would not disqualify the mikvah. Avol shlosha lugin latana kama possibly, but as we explained before, now the Gemara is saying it. If the inference is that if there were three lugin of water, the rabbis would say it disqualifies the mikvah. V'azer Rabbi Yochanan lemeimar akol eichach armar, and it comes along Rabbi Yochanan and tells us everything's based on sight, on appearance. The Rav Omer Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri, and Rav is in accordance with Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri. That's exactly everything that I said outside. That was what the Gemara just said now. O Dilma, maybe there's an alternative way to understand its machlokis. Maybe Rav lo tani chaser korta veresha. Maybe Rav's understanding of the Mishnah, his text, did not have the word chaser in there. Rav Yochanan ben Nuri ki polig aseifa hu de polig. What's Rav Yochanan arguing on? He's only arguing when it comes to milk. The Rav de Omer kedivrei akol. And Rav is really in agreement with both Rabbanan and Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri. Now, let's take a step back and outside and unpack what that means. So here is the alternative way to understand the machlokas. Let's say the Mishnah did not have the word chaser. So what's the case? The Rabbanan say, if there are three lugin of water and you add a kortav of, an extra kortav of wine in there, it will not disqualify the mikvah. Same thing with milk. If there's three lugin of water and you put the milk in there also, it's when it comes to milk, so it depends. The milk will actually remain the same. When it comes to milk, it still needs to be 2.9 kortav. But according to Rabbanan, the Rabbanan are willing to be modeh. They're willing to change their shita a little bit according to Rav, that if you have three lugin of water and you add wine into there, even the Rabbanan, who usually say as long as there's three lugin, game over, actually even they would concede to Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri that if as the appearance of wine, it will not invalidate the mikvah. So that actually fits with Rav as well. So the only thing that the Rabbanan and Rabbi Yochanan are really arguing about has nothing to do with wine. Everyone agrees, Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri and the Rabbanan, even if there's three lugin of water, if it has the appearance of wine, it will not disqualify the mikvah. What are they arguing about? Their argument is more limited in scope. Their argument is just about when you have 2.9 kortavs and you add milk to it. So according to Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri, he says the same thing as before. The milk will not be neutral. The milk will actually contribute and create three lugin of water. Whereas the Rabbanan say, no, it needs to be three lugin of H2O. It cannot be milk in there as well. That's what they're arguing about. But perhaps everybody agrees that if you have three lugin of water, even three lugin, and you add in wine, it will not invalidate the mikvah. So why does Rav need to be lined up? Why does he need to be pigeonholed into Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri's shita? Really, he fits according to Rav and Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri, perhaps. That's what Rav Papa is suggesting. Okay. So that's another possible reading. Is there anything I can do to this is like really complicated here. I'm going to admit that. This is kind of like I have to sit down and work it through myself. Jenny.
Does it matter if it's white wine or red wine?
Ah, very good. Someone asked that last time, I remember. I forgot who asked it, but who was it? Zadie asked the same question. So Zadie and Jenny asked the same question. So we're talking about red wine because I think you're right. The same thing would apply. I think white wine would be in the same category as milk. In fact, I think it would even make less of a dent of coloration in the water. Again, we need to experiment at home, you know. Take out your wines and take out your water. And, you know, this is a good, if I was like a classroom teacher in high school and, you know, I was giving a class every day on this topic, like one day I would just bring in all these materials and do it in front of the class. But I'm sure we could, our imaginations will hopefully suffice.
But then we're wasting wine.
What was that?
Then we're wasting wine.
Wasting of wine. Well, it wouldn't be actually a waste if it's serving a purpose.
We tried that years ago. There's a Gemara in Beitzah, the Shinola B'Yontov, whether it's muxer or not. What could you use the egg for? So the Gemara said you could use it to support a bet. No one knew what that means. This was in high school. We brought eggs into the classroom and tried to experiment, you know, with the desks. It made a mess on the floor. So I don't know if it's a good
So yeah, those are fun. You know, it'd be crazy to go into Maseches Gittin and Avodah Zarah, another place where you have all the refuah gemaras, and you say, hang a chicken on the left door over there, it'll heal you from your headaches or something. You know,
there you go.
All sorts of weird medical advice that it wasn't just what the rabbis believed. That was the common knowledge of their days. That's what the scientists back then said, or whatever they had. So, you know, it's a lot of fun material to experiment with, which was, I'm sure, debunked. Okay, so things get simpler from here on out. So if you got what we got until now, it's easy sailing, smooth sailing from here. If you didn't quite get it as much, well, the rest of this should hopefully be more straightforward. And I'm happy to go back and work with anyone understanding this. So the question is, why with Rav Papa, it was very unclear what the girsa, what the text was of this Mishnah. Let's see, where did we leave off? Rav Papa mi vayle le Rava pshitale. Okay, Rav Papa, he needs to get his records in order, but Rava, he was very confident in his reading of the Mishnah. So Rava still believes that the Rabbanan say three lugan of water, game over, even if there's wine. So according to Rava, Rav needs to be aligned with Rav Yochanan ben Nuri. Okay. I'm Rav Yosef. Now, this is important to know. Rashi points this out, that Rav Yosef Chol v'Shachach Tamud. Rav Yosef was a great scholar, but later in life, he forgot. Something happened to his health, and he forgot much of what he learned. So what would happen is his student, Abaye, many times would remind Rav Yosef about what he taught Abaye previously. So we're going to see that dynamic here in the Gemara. I'm Rav Yosef, lo shmia li hashmaisa. I don't really know which way we should learn this Mishnah, with the word chaser or without the word chaser. Amalei Abaye, at amrit lo nilan. You taught this to us. V'halchi amrit nilan. This is what you told us. The Rav lo tani chaser korta bereisha. You taught us like the second reading that omits the word chaser, and that the Rabbanan and Rav Yochanan ben Nuri are in agreement that wine will prevent the water from disqualifying the mikvah. Rav Yochanan asefa palak. Rav Yochanan and Rabbanan, they only argue when it comes to milk, whether milk will combine with the water or not. Rav tamar kedivrei kol, and therefore Shalma Yisrael. Rav is in accordance with the Rabbanan. Rav is in accordance with Rav Yochanan ben Nuri because they all agree when it comes to wine. They only argue when it comes to milk. Rav's statement was only about three lugan with wine. Therefore, Rav is in accordance with both opinions in the Mishnah, according to Abaye in the name of Rav Yosef. Okay, end of that piece. We're going to have one other mikvos piece. But this one is much more straightforward. So let's jump right into that. Okay, and then I'll have a Hilchos Pesach point that I want to bring up, Halacha Lemaisa, which I think will be interesting. Henry knows what I'm talking about because he was in shul. He heard the beginning in between Milchama Arba. I made a preview. So we'll get the answer tonight. We're in the middle of the page. I can't even see how many lines up or down. It looks like we're smack in the middle. Amar Rav Yehuda Amar Rav Chavis Malaya Maim Shnafel Leyam Hagadol Hatovel Shamlo Also Lo Tfila. If let's say you go to the Mediterranean Sea, you go to the separate beach of Tel Aviv, and you pour a little bit of wine into the water over there, and then immediately you go ahead and you want to be Tovel in the sea over there. You know, the sea is like the first mikvah ever made, right? It's the world's most natural mikvah. Best mikvah you could use. When I go to Bayswater, where my grandfather lives. So there, it's called Bayswater because there's a bay. So we'll go there, and that's where we'll tovel our dishes. So, it's very easy in Bayswater. You don't even need to bring things to the Kala mikvah. You just drive right up to the water. You put things in. You hopefully don't get attacked by a flock of geese, and then you make your escape. So let's say you pour a little bit of wine into the sea over there. Chayshinan l'shlosha lugin shloyu b'malkum echad. V'davka liyama gadol d'koy v'kayama. Avol nar ba'ama lo. So if you pour in, my mistake. Not wine. The next part is wine. If you take, let me just rewind. I jumped ahead a little bit. The case here is, again, I take 3 lugin of water. 3 lugin can disqualify a mikvah, and I pour it into, right? Let's say, I have this devious idea. I want to try to disqualify all the water in the world, right? So I'll pour the 3 lugin into the water in the sea, and then I am tovel, I immerse myself in there. So, either I'm putting a kli in there or I'm tame, someone, is a nida, they want to make sure that they're tahora now. So the water will not effectuate a tahara process. I will go in there tame, spiritually impure. I will come out still tame. Why? Because we're afraid that the 3 lugin of water stayed where I put it in originally. And by the way, this only applies dafka. I mean, Bayswater actually is a great example. It's a bay. This applies to the Mediterranean, apparently a certain area of the Mediterranean, because the waters there are very much stagnant. And we're concerned that in stagnant waters, the 3 lugin of disqualified water will stay in its place. The 3 lugin will stay in its place. And when I go into that water, the issue is when I immerse myself in the mikvah, I have to go completely into the mikvah. Every inch of my body needs to come in contact with the water. I mean, not inside my mouth. That's the roi libilo. That's a whole other saga. But I have to basically, the whole external part of my body, everything needs to be touching the water. So if my body is partially immersed in 3 lugin of mayim shu'uvim, of disqualified waters, it can't be said that I'm fully immersing in kosher mikvah water. That is an issue that comes up in stagnant waters. And Tani Nami Haki, we have a brisa that gives us a very similar case. Again, another older, earlier Taniitic source, which we cite as precedent. Tani Nami Haki, Chavis Malaya Yain, Shnafa Liyam HaGadol, Atol Sham Lo Also Lo Tfila. That if I have a barrel full of wine that falls into the Mediterranean Sea, if I immerse in there, my tvila is ineffective. My immersion does not work. Why? Same concern. We're concerned that I'm partially immersing in wine. I'm not completely immersing myself in water. The next few words actually should be taken out of the Gemara. It doesn't fit in. From Chayshin L'Shosh L'Yishuv and Shalib B'Makom Echad. What's his name? The Maram actually takes it out. I'm not going to explain, but basically these words don't fit the context here because it talks about water, not wine. The chen kikar shel truma shnafel shem tamei. Now here's the interesting thing. If I am tamei, now the wine is tahor. The wine is spiritually pure. But if I then go in and we're concerned that I am impure and I am touching that wine, I'm going to render that wine tamei as well. So what's the issue if the wine is tamei? Well, if I take a piece of truma, truma is a gift that's given to the Kohanim. It's given to the priest. Zadie and all of our other numerous Kohanim that are with us today. So they get truma back in the good old days. So the truma, though, is not supposed to become tame. It's supposed to remain tahor because it's a holy food. So if I put some truma in that water right after I immersed in it, the truma also will be halakhically rendered tame because I went in, were concerned that that some of the liquid there is wine I touch. I rendered the wine tame. And then when I put Truma in there, which was tower, was great, it also is going to contract the Tuma from it, and it's going to become tame. It's going to become spiritually impure as well. Now, my Vachim, what's the Chiddush? I mean, if you tell me that we're concerned the wine is there, and if I go in, I'll render it impure, what's the Chiddush? What is the Gemara? What's the Brisa coming to tell me that if I put anything else in there, it'll also become tame? I could infer that from the fact that my tefillah didn't work because we're afraid that I'm touching the wine. So my Vachim, what would have I said? Hosom uki gavra achazoke, hacha uki truma achazoka, kamash malon. What would have I said? I would have applied the principle of chazaka. What's the principle of chazaka? The idea that we assume when there's a suffix, generally we assume if there's a doubt, we rely on we keep things in the status quo. So this comes up in monetary law many times. We see hamotzi michavero olav harayim. If Reuven and Shimon get into a dispute, Reuven claims that Shimon's computer belongs to him. Well, until Reuven can bring valid admissible proof to Beis Din that that computer belongs to him, or, you know, let's say they're arguing over a car. So until he could present the deed to Beis Din and prove that's his, in a case of doubt, we leave it with the person who currently is holding it, because we keep the status quo until we have a significant reason to change the status quo. And I think that's a very logical idea. We didn't necessarily need halacha to come along and tell us that. So what's the chiddush over here? What we're learning here is that we don't rely on a chazaka. So I would have said, if we have a doubt over here, we don't know if the wine is still in the place that I poured it in. So if I'm Moshe Kurtz, I am Tame. I came in contact with a dead body. I need to go to mikvah now. So if I want to immerse in there, there's a doubt. There's a suffix if I am immersing in water completely or if I'm partially immersing in wine. So because there's a suffix, because there's an uncertainty, we maintain the status quo. We maintain that I am still Tame until we could conclusively prove otherwise.
Even though you say Safek Yoraita L'chumra in a case like that?
Even though what?
Even though you might say that Safek, if it's a Yoraita Tuma, that you go L'chumra, even though the Chazaka would override that?
The Chazaka. Wait, so you're saying the Gemara shouldn't be saying... You're saying that he should be Tahor?
No, he should be Tame. If it's a Safek, you'd say Safek, yeah. Right to the Lumra, right?
And that is what the Gemara is saying. That's not the Chiddush. The Chiddush, the novelty here, is that the Truma has a status quo of being Tahor, of being spiritually pure. And I would think if there's a doubt whether there's Tame wine there or not, we should maintain the status quo, the chazaka, that the Truma remains tahor until I can conclusively prove otherwise. So that's what the Bryce is coming to tell us. That this Truma, I would have said that the Truma should be now spiritually pure and maintain the status quo, because I don't know if the Tame wine is still in that quadrant of the water. But nonetheless, comes along the Chachamim and they say that we treat it as Tame now, even in the case of Suffolk. Now, why? Why in the case of Suffolk is it different? So there's two opinions. One opinion given is, I have it up over here. There are two opinions why that's the case. Opinion number one is that in Shir Rabbi Shmuel, it says that it's just a Chumrah. Really? You're right. The Truma should still be Tahor. But the Chachamim, the rabbis, were very careful when it came to the laws of Truma. And they said, even in a case of suffix, in a case of doubt, the Truma will become Tame. So, okay, there's nothing really special. It just means that it's a Chumrah. It's a stringency that the rabbis created. But the other opinion is a little bit more lumpish. I'll just finish this thought and then I'll take your points. The other idea, which is given, that there's some of Farshim who say, since the beginning of this discussion was through the perspective of the person who was immersing himself And there we said that the wine is probably there and will render him still tamei. Therefore, at the end of the case also, since we already ruled that we're concerned that the wine is there, we're also concerned still there for the truma. But let's say we took the man out of the equation. There was just wine over there that was tamei, and then you put the truma in the water. The truma might still be tahor. It's only because we said, because we first had to analyze the case of the man going in there to immerse himself, that we ruled that the wine is there and tamei, it's going to keep him tamei. So do we say the same thing for the truma? Okay, that's an additional thought. But it sounds like, Phyllis, you have a question?
Yeah, I'm kind of surprised when that barrel of water drops into the Mediterranean Sea. What happened to the three lugin? I mean, the Mediterranean Sea is a vast body of water. I could understand if they were talking about a pond or a lake, but a sea?
Very good.
I don't get it.
So Frecht Phyllis Akasha. Phyllis asked the question that's bothering all the Rishonim here in the Sugya. And this brings us into a practical question that we have. So to answer this question, I want to present another question. Very Jewish, I know. So the question is, if this is true, that we're concerned that three lugin of water is going to stay where I poured it, the issues can become cataclysmic. Imagine this. Imagine you go to the Kinneret. The Kinneret is a huge lake in Israel, for those of us who are not familiar. And it's Pesach time. Somebody pours in whiskey, scotch, into the Kinneret. Now, I wouldn't actually drink from the Kinneret because a lot of people bathing in there, so I personally wouldn't. But is it now usur, the entire Pesach, for me to drink from the Kinneret because there's a little bit of whiskey somewhere in there? Do I have to go to the opposite side of the Kinneret now to make sure I'm not drinking any of that whiskey? I mean, like Phyllis, exactly what you're saying. Let's bring this to its logical conclusion. I mean, I shouldn't be able to drink from the Kinneret on Pesach if someone pours in a jar, you know, some wild turkey. Well, that's bourbon. Maybe not as bad. But
as someone pours in scotch. As you said before, you shouldn't drink at all at any time from the Kinneret.
Well, from a health perspective, what about strictly from a legal halachic perspective? Hilchos Pesach.
What about from a regular kosher perspective? You have no idea what a ham sandwich could have been put in there.
A ham sandwich could have been put in there. Excellent. So now, what would you all say? Basic kashrus knowledge here. Why would you think it wouldn't be a problem in general for the ham sandwich?
Why are we talking about eating? Why not just bathing?
Oh, let's do one at a time. Okay. Henry, Toby, Jenny, and Phyllis.
So the ham sandwich would be batal, but the yichametz is usur even in a b'mashu, even in an infinitesimal.
Right. Okay.
Very good. Was that what you were all going to say? Toby, Jenny, Phyllis? Yeah.
Well, why are we talking about immersing?
So Toby and Jenny, you'll get credit for it. Phyllis, is there something?
Yeah, we're not talking about eating. We're talking about immersing.
It's the same. Okay, good. I'll clarify. It's the same issue at hand. The same issue. The principle of the matter is that when it comes to immersion, the concern is that the liquid remains in the same place that you put it. The concern with drinking, again, is that the liquid stays in the same place. So we're talking about two different actions, but the same issue is at hand. The principle is that we believe that the liquid doesn't move too far from where you poured it in. So as Henry rightly pointed out, in general, right, in Jenny's case, you put some non-kosher food in there, great. It's batel barov. There's way more water than there is of any of like that non-kosher beverage liquid that you put in there. It's not going to be an issue. But the issue that Henry points out is that we have a principle that when it comes to Pesach, chametz is also afilu b'mashehu, that even a little bit, we don't say batel b'shishim, we don't say 1-60 ratio, it'll be okay. Even a little smidgen of chametz, a little quart of a chametz, gets found inside that measurement and you have a lot of water, it doesn't matter. The entire beverage is now considered chametz. That's a special rule when it comes to Pesach. Why is that? There's a lot of lumdus about that. But let's just assume that it's a chumrah midrabbanan. That's a rabbinic stringency when it comes to Pesach. By the way, we'll have to schedule a halacha l'maaseh this year when it comes to Pesach. But just because chametz can asur in mixture with even a little bit of chametz doesn't mean also that you'll be violating the isser b'ayir b'ayimatzeh of having chametz inside your household if there's only a mashuv. You don't need to actually, if there's like little crumbs of chametz on the floor, you don't have to have anxiety trying to pick up every last crumb. It needs to be at least a kezias. It needs to be like, you know, like a little piece of, a real piece of something. It can't just be little crumbs. So, I mean, you might want to clean crumbs up just to be clean in general, but from a halakhic perspective, you don't need to cause yourself so much agmas nefesh and anxiety trying to get every last crumb off the floor. But if that little crumb does go into your food, then it could actually asser all the food. I just assume that most crumbs that are on the floor are not finding their way into my cake. I think that's a fair assumption. Maybe. Hopefully not. Then there's health issues as well. So what is the answer to this question? Pesach presents an even bigger issue. So Rav Zilberstein, the Chashukei Chemed, he says it's based on three different opinions in Rishonim, how to understand why in the world do we think that the liquid is going to stay, that the wine is going to stay in that exact place that I put it in? It's going to spread throughout the water, even if the water is stagnant. What am I concerned about? So there's three opinions. The Ravon says that actually, if you wait like 30 minutes or an hour, you wait a significant amount of time, you actually could assume that the liquid is already dissipated and spread to all arpa kanfos saaretz, that spread all throughout the entire water. So if you wait for the whiskey to just dissipate a little bit, you actually would be allowed to drink from the water over there. And what about, and then the other opinion is that, what's the case of the Gemara where you gently put the liquid into the water? You have a barrel, then you unplug the barrel in the water and it stays right where it is. But if you pour it into the water with force, of course it'll spread around due to the impact. And the third opinion is that, again, we need to do a science experiment for it, but when it comes to the Yam HaGadol, the Mediterranean, which is salt water, something sweet, something sweeter would not mix, the wine would not mix with the water so well. But something like the Kinneret, for instance, which is a sweeter kind of water, the wine will dissipate in it faster. Is that scientifically true? I have no clue. But apparently the Ritva thought so. So again, you know, this is something that if I were working at a school, I'd do like a cross collaboration with the science teacher. And, you know, that'd be like a whole class for the day or something, a whole symposium. But I don't know, maybe we'll get together. If anyone wants to do it sometime, we can get together, or you can do it in your kitchens and report to me what happens. If anyone has like a Kinneret in the back of their kitchen.
I might point out that whether it's the Mediterranean or the Kinneret or any substantial body of water, they are not stagnant. They're always in motion.
Right. So I think the question is how significant the motion is. So even if like there's always little waves going around, is that significant enough that it's going to make all of that liquid dissipate? That's a question. But Zadia, that is, of course, I that is true, that there's always going to be some form of force and motion just by virtue of fish being in there, people, anything, it's going to cause.
There were currents.
Exactly.
Layback, and there were currents.
Right. Yeah, it is a little weird with the Mediterranean because I do remember there being waves, if I'm not mistaken. So I'm not sure why the Gemara describes it as stagnant. Ah, so now back to our question. That's all fine and dandy. But what about on Pesach? Again, on Pesach, Hari Chometz of Pesach also afil b'mashehu, like Henry pointed out. Even a little smidgen of chametz. The entire Kinneret should now be usher on Pesach. And you put a little bit of whiskey into the Mediterranean. Well, that's connected to all the oceans of the world. Shkayach, someone with a few drops of whiskey just rendered all the waters of the ocean and everything connecting to it usher to drink from on Pesach. Right? Not that anyone's drinking salt water thing, but just like imagine it. Isn't that crazy? So there's an answer to this question. There's a few answers, but the main one really is that the principle that chametz is oser afil b'mashehu, that even a little smidgen of chametz can render an entire beverage oser on Pesach, it'll be chametz on Pesach, that is a rabbinical stringency. So there's a classic principle, hey mamru vehe mamru, the rabbis giveth, the rabbis taketh. So the same way they have a right to institute a stringency, they could also revoke it when they choose to do so. So when there's something called Gezeira She'ina Tzibur Yachol Lamopa, which is sometimes the rabbi said, really, we would love to institute something, but we know the community is not going to be able to handle it. So therefore, we are not going to institute this Gezeira, or arguably, we don't have the power to institute such an enactment. It's an interesting point. So when it comes to rivers, and according to some opinions, even according to wells, which are somehow connected to natural water sources in the world, those sources of water, since they're needed by everybody, will not become Asur on Pesach. Otherwise, you know, before you could have bottled water, if somebody wanted to be a jerk and just render the town well, Chametz on Pesach, no one would have anything to drink. That'd be crazy, right? So Chametz said, you know, maybe when it comes to your cake, if a little bit of Chametz gets in, the whole cake will be Asur. But you can't just put a little bit of whiskey into the Kinneret and then render the entire Kinneret Chametz. That doesn't happen. But, you know, if someone was like a trickster and wanted to pull a prank on the entire Jewish nation, and that rule was not in effect, it caused some very serious damage, right? Okay. Were there any other questions or thoughts before we go on to the Mishnah and conclude the Shiur for tonight? Anything else I could clarify? Any thoughts or insights that you want to share? Okay, great. Again, it's one of those things that I hope was clear. I know we ran through it quickly, but hopefully it was beneficial. Now, somebody, I think Howard Weiss, you said last time that, what does this all have to do with Makos? And the answer is, none of this has anything to do with Makos. But if you remember, we had a statement from Rav that was relevant to Makos. And then the Gemara said, let's go deeper down the rabbit hole and just share miscellaneous teachings from Rav. And that's how we have this whole entire sugya about mikvos. Well, guess what? It's about time. We decided we missed Makos. We missed the good old lashes. And we are getting back on track. So you thought we were learning Makos? Well, we're getting back to Makos. So not to worry. So we are up to the Mishnah. The Mishnah, well, you can see, is toward the bottom of the page with the words Masnisim. Me'idin anu be'ish ploni shechai l'chaveru masayim zuz. So remember we had our good old friends, the Edom Zomimin, the perjurious witnesses, and we learned that if two witnesses are found to be Edom Zomimin, they get the punishment that they sought to accuse, that they accused the defendant of. Again, there are certain conditions to make it happen. We'll talk about that more again later. Now, let's say they testified that Reuven owes Shimon $200. And then what happens is they become Edom Zomimin. So now they owe Reuven $200 collectively. Vinitsu Zomimin. Lokin Umisham, not only, according to Ramir, this is the minority opinion. I want to preface before we get all confused. The minority opinion, which I did not bring up in previous shiurim because we don't paskin like this, says not only do you have to pay the 200 zuz that you accused him of owing Shimon, but you will also get 39 lashes along with it as well. We give you a double whammy. Why? Shelo Hashem ha-mevin li-dei makos mevin li-dei tashlumin, do you Rabbi Meir? Because the source that causes you to have to pay 200 zuz is not the same pasuk that makes you get 39 lashes. And remember, we talked about this in the past. There are two sources for false witnesses. The first source is a generic one, Lusan Breyache Shakur, the ninth commandment, that you shouldn't lie in Beis Din, you shouldn't lie in a Jewish court. So that is a generic 39 lashes. But if you became Edom Zomimin, if you were proven to be lying, conspiring witnesses through Edom Zomimin, remember Edom Zomimin, you were with us in California when that happened in New York, so we can testify, and you become Edom Zomimin as well. Well, Edom Zomimin has a special punishment that it's the Bockert punishment. You get, it takes the form of whatever you tried to cause to the defendant. So according to Rabbi Meir, it's not either or. Why not both? Efter l'kayim shneim, you could get Malkus because of Losana, because of the ninth commandment. And you could get also have to pay 200 zuz because of being Edom Zomimin. We give you both. That's what Rabbi Meir suggests. We do not hold like this, however. No, once you're paying, you don't get Malkus. Once you pay 200 zuz, Edom Zomimin, the parsha of Edom Zomimin, overrides the generic 39 lashes. Remember, that's what we've been assuming until now. That's what the Chachamim say. You get either one or the other. We'll learn it next year. The principle is called Kedei Risha. So you only get punished for one Risha, for one evil deed. You don't get two punishments for only doing one evil deed.
So So why are they bringing this up now and not before?
Because, well, before when?
Previously, when we discussed this about the
so what's important
and
to keep
the
in mind,
versus the
I'll keep it. What's important to keep this in mind, Phyllis, is that this is only our fourth Mishnah. So the way the Mishnah was composed, and like on Fridays, Gloria and Marina are with us on Fridays. Maybe some other people, you'll forgive me for not giving you a shout out. But on Fridays before Shabbos, we do Mishnayos Makos. So if you just learn Mishnayos, you're learning one after the other after the other. You don't have all these sugyas about mikvos and prosbol, shvias, all that fun stuff in between. So if you were just reading through the Mishnayos alone, you took away all the gemaras in between, you'd be up to this Mishnah in your first night of shir. You'd be up to this in 2 seconds.
Yeah.
So really, you would learn all this information really fast. Okay. I had to give all the background information because I knew that would be a few weeks until we got the Dalet Amud Aleph. But really, the intention is that you go through all Mishnayos first, and then later you learn all the Gemaras. But alas, we don't all have the luxury of doing that. But that's why I waited until now. It's not really waiting until now. The Talmud assumes that you've already learned all Shishi Sirei Mishnah. That you've learned all Mishnayos already. That's why it starts in Makos from Sanhedrin. That assumes that you learned Sanhedrin already as well. Okay. Now, we have a similar case with the same principle at the end of the Mishnah. Let's make it interesting. What if we testify that the defendant committed a sin that would incur Malkus, that would incur 39 lashes? Now what happens according to Rai Meir? Well, Lokin Shmonim. Then you get 80 Malkus. You get two sets of Malkus. Mishum, why? Here, now it's explicit. Mishum lo sana reacha ed shaker, because you shouldn't be a false witness. And umishum asisim lo kasher zamam, because of Eim Zomim, Divrei Meir. You get the generic 39 lashes for lying in court, and you get another 39 lashes for being Eim Zomim, because you accuse the defendant of doing something that would incur 39 lashes. So what do you get? You get two sets of 39 lashes. Because of the Sabriyaka Eid Shakir, and because of that season low Kasher Zamam. Divrei Rai Meir, that's the opinion of Rai Meir. Same principle again. We just get punished for both Psukim. But for Chum Omrim, Ain Lokel Arabayim. No, you only get one punishment. So you only get Adam Zomim in punishment when you qualify for that status. You don't get the generic Losan of Recha Eid Shakir. So you only get one set of 39 lashes, the same way you would only pay 200 Zuz if that's what you accused the defendant of. Okay, and that brings us precisely to Bava Dalet Amud Aleph. And next time, we will open up with the Gemara elaborating on this Mishnah. Ad kan dvarai, that is everything that we have to learn tonight with 5 minutes to spare. Once again, this is the end of this year, but I will stay on for a few more minutes to address and clarify any questions that people may have. A lot of stuff still buzzing around, right?
We're up to 4B next time?
Next time we will be on 4B to the first power.
Okay.
That's the thing, the first power. You know what I mean when I say that, right? 4B, 1, 4B squared, 4B, 3 to the third power, just to help direct people. Okay, great. Does anyone have any questions before I log off?
Thank you.
All right.
Thanks, Ashokar.
Thanks, Shalom.
If anyone has any questions at any point, you're always welcome to reach out.
Yeah. Thank you, Rabbi.
Thank you. Shabbos, everybody.
Hey, Rabbi.
Shannon, do you have a question?
Actually, I had a thought that I was interested in running by you with regard to this Talmud class, or maybe other things that you do. Have you heard of a new social media platform called Clubhouse?
Not, but I'm intrigued.
Oh, okay. Has anyone else on this call heard about this? No? You remember like AOL chat rooms where you could just like go into different rooms and start like typing with people? Well, this is like the same kind of thing, except it's with like audio. So you can like have conversations. And I think that this would be a really important platform for like Jewish thought leaders to start sharing stuff. It's obviously it's open to the world, like people pop in. It's like just, I don't know, it's kind of the new hot thing. And I've been thinking about this in terms of this class. If Rabbi Kurtz was interested. So. Sorry, I didn't mean to like necessarily get everyone involved. It was just like okay. something I'm planning on bringing up.
Well, you know, you have on here is a lot of committed people. Oh, Toby, you're muted right now.
You know, I think that...
What would that accomplish? That would accomplish bringing in other people who are not part of the Shear now? Is that the idea? Or...
It could, I mean, it could be for the, I don't know. I don't know. This is Rabbi Kurtz's class. Like it's totally your.
Yeah, no. But I'm saying like, what is the benefit of a platform? Like,
so my thought was it could be, yeah, it could be for, if part of the appeal here was to bring it to a wider audience, that's something that like people are particularly, I don't know if you're, you know, reaching a certain, I will put it a certain demographic, I suppose as well of, tech savvy people who are like part of this exclusive community for now or whatever to do this. I would think it would increase buzz for Rabbi Kurtz, the Stanford community, et cetera. I don't know. It's like marketing, I guess, in a way, right? Like it's, I mean, you could use it for whatever.
But you're not just finding out about this year. You're actually participating in it on this platform, right?
People can, I mean, you can do both. It's if you someone moderates and they can allow certain people to speak. I don't know that it's necessarily good for this particular class if like this is much more of a conversation between just like the very committed people here. But it's but other people can just also tune in. It's almost like a live stream podcast. It's like that's what you're setting up basically.
This would be open to the general public.
And it could be open to the general public. Again, don't know if Rabbi Kurtz is interested in making this available to the general public or if this is supposed to be a
I think there's a lucky problem with that because you're not supposed to teach halakha to non-Jews.
Oh, well, Zadie, that's a whole separate shear.
Oh, is that a problem?
It's not a problem. I'll tell you why. It's a tshuva of the Sridei Esh. This is a good Monday night topic. We'll, God willing, do in the future. Have that docketed, actually, teaching Torah to non-Jews. The idea is, you know, the issue that he had was there was a radio show in Israel, and they teach Torah on that radio show. It's a religious station, so anyone could tune into it. The idea is that you're teaching a Jewish audience, and if someone non-Jewish wants to tune in, then you're not said to be teaching to someone who's non-Jewish. Also, chances are if someone is tuning in, like, you know, who knows, maybe they're considering conversion. They want to find out about Judaism. So there's that's a whole shear unto itself. But Zay, that's a good point. Good thing to consider. Anyway, Jenny, that's, you know, I never heard of this, but I want to look into it. So it's called what again?
It's called Clubhouse. I'll send you a brief article I read about it.
Okay.
So, I'm always... Right now it's an invite only. You just seem like someone who's like very tech savvy and tech forward, and it seemed like something that might be a thing.
I'm always open to looking into new things, so we'll check it out. So please send it to me.
Email offline.
Okay, great. Thank you so much. All right, Yasher Koach, Jenny, and Yasher Koach, everyone. Have a great Shabbos.
Good night, everyone.
Good Shabbos, everyone. Thank you.